Hi, everybody. Welcome to Your Move, where we help you make better decisions and live with fewer regrets. I'm Andy Stanley, and I'll be your guide. Did you know that something can be not wrong and unwise at the same time? And why is that important? Because your greatest regret, hate to bring it up, but your greatest regret was preceded by a series of not wrong decisions, but unwise decisions. So let's not do that anymore. And today I will tell you how, right here on Your Move. So when our kids were old enough to drive, I decided not to give them a curfew, a specific time to be home. And the reason is this: my personal experience with curfew as a teenage driver convinced me that the traditional approach to curfew is a terrible idea. At 16 years old, curfew transformed me into an overly aggressive weekend driver. Now, on weekdays, I was fine, but on Friday and Saturday nights, not so much. And you know why? Because on Friday and Saturday nights, I found myself suffering from the five-minute syndrome. You know what this is? I can stay just 5 more minutes. And then 5 minutes later, I can just stay 5 minutes. I've got 5 more minutes. And before long, I had to be home in, you guessed it, actually, maybe you remember it. I had to be home in five minutes, regardless of how many minutes it would actually take me to get home, which explains my overly aggressive weekend driving. So when my kids started driving, I didn't tell them what time to be home. I told them what time to leave for home. And thanks to cell technology, I knew if they left on time. Now, you have experienced some version of this curfew dynamic as an adult, where your margin for error got gobbled up with just 5 more minutes thinking, whether it was one more drink, one more business trip, one more sleeve of cookies, one more pair of shoes, one more swipe of the credit card. Whatever it is, the outcome is usually the same. And here's where the math begins to fall apart. One more rarely adds anything. When it comes to 5-minute thinking, 5 more minute thinking, one more rarely adds anything. In fact, worse, it usually subtracts. One more actually results in less, oftentimes, of what we value the most, right? And while it's been a while since curfew dictated your driving habits, your current driving habits, in fact, are influenced by a similar dynamic. Unless you are a very unusual driver, you drive either at or slightly above the posted speed limit, right? And while most of us feel little to no guilt driving faster than the posted speed limit, none of us want to get pulled over. So what do we do? Well, we choose the speed that we're convinced allows us to break the law while avoiding an encounter with the law. And my point, whether it's curfew, diet, driving, spending, our natural inclination, you know this, our natural inclination is to live as close to the line as possible. Which line? Well, the line between legal and illegal, the line between responsible and irresponsible, the line between moral and immoral, the line between ethical and unethical, the line between I'm still in control and I need help. And it's just human nature. It's human nature to snuggle up to the edge of irresponsibility, disaster, embarrassment, and to stay there as long as possible. It's human nature to get by with as much as we can get by with without becoming our own worst enemy, without being grounded, embarrassed, or expelled, fired, or kicked out of the house. And here's the thing. Fueling this incessant flirtation with disaster is a flawed assumption that informs so many of our decisions. An assumption that, well, it basically impedes our ability to make good decisions. And this assumption is why I think we're so comfortable living, dating, spending, eating, drinking, and driving on the edge of embarrassment or worse. And so for the sake of clarity, I'll illustrate this assumption with 4 contrasting ideas. Here's the assumption I'm talking about. If it's not wrong, well, then it's all right. If it's not illegal, then clearly it's permissible. If it's not immoral, it's acceptable. And if it's not over the line, it's fine. Now, if the problem with this way of thinking is not immediately apparent, just put on your older or brother sister hat for a moment. If you're a parent, just put on your parent hat for a moment. I bet, and we've never met probably, but I bet you don't set the bar that low for your children. You don't set the bar that low for anybody that you care about. To embrace these assumptions is to organize your life or to organize somebody else's life around the lowest common denominator, right? Essentially, we're asking, how low can I go? How close to bad can I get without actually being bad? How close to wrong can I get without actually doing something wrong? Or if you're religious, how close to sin can I get without actually sinning? But it doesn't stop there, does it? Before long, we're asking, how far over the line can I go without getting caught or experiencing any consequences? How unethical, how immoral, how insensitive can I be without creating unmanageable outcomes? How long can I neglect my family or my finances or my health without feeling the effects? How much can I indulge an addictive behavior without actually becoming addicted? It's a slippery, dangerous slope. And it all begins by asking the wrong question. Is there anything wrong with this? A question that usually leads to a second question. How did I get myself into this? Drawing our lines, setting our limits, and establishing our moral or ethical standards on the borderline between right and wrong, legal, illegal, healthy and unhealthy, eliminates any margin for error. It is a foolish and it's a dangerous way to live. And here's the thing. I haven't told you anything you don't already know. We already know this, right? It's why we respond the way we do when someone we love starts snuggling up to one of those elusive lines, right? We don't react to what they're doing, do we? We react to where they're heading. In those moments, we just know intuitively that the issue isn't, in fact, the question isn't, is there anything wrong, illegal, or immoral about what they're doing? We know intuitively that there's a more important question, a better question that needs to be asked. A question that if we ask it, if they ask it, will ensure a better decision. A question that if asked and answered honestly and acted on will ensure that they avoid avoidable regret. And the truth is this, if you'll get in the habit of asking this better question, you'll avoid avoidable regret as well. And that question is the fourth of five questions we're exploring in this series, Better Decisions, Fewer Regrets. Better decisions, fewer regrets. Now, if you've been tracking along with this, you know that the idea behind this series is the often overlooked relationship between good questions and good decisions. Good questions actually set us up for better decisions. It could be argued that the decisions you make are no better than the questions that you ask. And I'm absolutely convinced that if you will ask and if you will answer honestly and if you will act on your answer to these five questions, you will make better decisions. And consequently, you will be forced to live with fewer regrets. Your life will be better. And the people who look to you, the people who depend on you, their lives will be better as well, because we aren't the only people impacted by our decisions, are we? And we aren't the only people impacted by our regrets either. Again, if you've been following along in this series, you'll know that the first question we explored is called the integrity question. The integrity question. And the integrity question is, am I being honest with myself? Am I being honest with myself really? The easiest person to deceive in your life is the person you see every morning in the mirror. And as long as you are lying to yourself, you will never get to where you want to be, because you'll never get to where you want to be until you're honest about where you currently are. Our second question is the legacy question. The legacy question is, what story do I want to tell? What story do I want to tell? When the decision you're in the process of making right now, whether it's relational, financial, academic, professional, whatever it is, when the decision that you're making right now is nothing more than a story you tell, what story do you want to tell? And the good news is you get to decide, but you decide the story of your life one decision at a time. Because as far as it's up to you, you write the story of your life one decision at a time. Now, last time we were together, we explored the conscience question. The third question is the conscience question. The conscience question is there attention that deserves my attention? When everything looks good on paper, when everybody's nodding in agreement, but there's something on the inside that just doesn't feel right about an option that you're considering. You can't put your finger on it, but there's just something not right. Pause and pay attention to that tension. And that brings us at last to our fourth question. And I call this one the maturity question. The maturity question. What is the wise thing to do? What is the wise thing to do? When making a decision of any consequence, I want you to pause and ask, okay, what is the wise thing for me to do? The option you're considering may be legal, may be acceptable, permissible, an industry standard, not exactly immoral, but is it wise? Now, Here's something mature people understand. This is why I love calling this the maturity question. Here's something that mature people understand and recognize and accept as fact. A decision, don't miss this, a decision can be both not wrong and unwise at the same time. A decision or an option you're exploring can be not wrong. It's not wrong, but it can be not wrong and unwise at the same time. Let me explain this. Isn't it true, and I hate to bring this up, but isn't it true that your greatest regret, and when I say greatest regret, I'm talking about that moment of regret, the moment that you would give almost anything to be able to go back and relive or undo, the decision you would like to be able to go back and unmake, the tipping point, the point of no return, that moment, isn't it true that your greatest regret was preceded by a series of unwise decisions? They weren't wrong, they weren't illegal, they weren't necessarily immoral, but looking back, they were terribly, terribly unwise. And that series of unwise decisions paved the way, think about it, paved the way to the moment in time you've regretted ever since. So to avoid 5 more minute syndrome, to create moral and ethical and financial margin, ask of every invitation, every opportunity, every option that comes your way, what is the wise thing for me to do? What is the wise thing for me to do? Now, the Apostle Paul spells this out for us in the letter that he wrote to Christians living in Ephesus. We call it the book of Ephesians. And here's what he writes, and he goes right to the heart of this tension that all of us live with and really that all of us wrestle with every single day. Here's what he writes. He says, be very careful then how you live. Be very careful then how you live. Not as unwise, here's our word, not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity because the days are evil. So while a lot has improved since the first century, apparently human nature has not. Ancient folks and us modern folks are equally prone to live carelessly and unwisely, to snuggle up to the edge of disaster and pretty much stay there as long as possible. And the Apostle Paul comes along, he says, stop it. I want you to be careful how you live. Don't be careless. This is the grid through which we are to evaluate every invitation, every opportunity that comes our way, financial, relational, professional, academic, whatever it might be. And thus our question, what is the wise thing to do? Paul continues with a bit more explanation. He says, making the most of every opportunity. Literally, in the Greek, this phrase could be translated literally, redeeming or ransoming the time. Redeeming or ransoming the time. This is where the English word opportunity comes from. Don't you wish, think about this, don't you wish you could go back and reclaim or redeem all the time you wasted on bad decisions, along with all the time you had to spend making up for those bad decisions? I do. And for you, that may be just a few weeks or weekends scattered around your past, but it might be an entire season of your life. Either way, imagine having the opportunity to relive or re-spend or reallocate those days, weeks, or even years, not to mention the money. I mean, what if you had an opportunity to go back and invest that time in more productive, healthy, life-giving activities? Imagine where you'd be today. And I know this is hard. As painful as it is to think back and to look back, it's necessary in order to appreciate the invitation embedded in the Apostle Paul's words, because here's what he's doing. Paul is inviting us to invest our time wisely from this moment forward, from this day forward. You are invited to make the most of, or to redeem, or to leverage your most valuable asset, your time, to invest your time in a way that actually propels you forward toward a preferred future. But he's not through. Then he tacks on this kind of odd warning. He writes, he's making the most of every opportunity because the days are evil. Evil days. What's he talking about? Well, you know this, we don't live in a morally, ethically neutral culture, do we, right? I mean, think about it. When is the last time you heard or saw or even read an ad that encouraged you to be careful, to be wise, to be self-controlled? I'm guessing maybe never. I mean, has a sales associate ever suggested you go home and think it over before making a purchase? Probably not. Which means, and this is Paul's point, this is on us. We aren't going to get much help from culture. The friends around us, maybe, but not culture. The gravitational pull of culture is what? It's now, not later. It's more, not less. This is why our fourth question, practically speaking, may in fact be the best question ever. It's why I call it the maturity question. So in an attempt to anchor your conscience to our fourth question, I want to suggest that you ask this question from three perspectives: your past, your present, and your future. In fact, this is the version I taught my children when they were growing up, and this is the version of the question I've taught some of you before. In light of my past experience, my current circumstances, and my future hopes and dreams, what is the wise thing for me to do? In light of my past experience, my current circumstances, my future hopes and dreams, what is the wise thing for me to do? Now, I imagine you're familiar with a little quip that says, those who can't remember the past are condemned or are doomed to repeat it. You've heard that before. Well, on a personal level, it could be restated this way. Those who don't pay attention to what got them into trouble yesterday are liable to wind up in the same trouble tomorrow. It's not as catchy, but you get the point. The point being this: our past, our personal past, predisposes us to specific temptations, addictions, blind spots, just to name a few, right? Temptations, addictions, and blind spots that may not be temptations, addictions, or blind spots to anybody else. So in light of your past experience, in light of your personal past experience, what is the wise thing for you to do? Every decision, every invitation, every opportunity that comes your way needs to be filtered through that question. I have a friend, I'll call him Steve, and Steve received some really unsettling advice about halfway through his premarital counseling with his soon-to-be wife, Shauna. The counselor said to Steve, in light of your family history, when you and Shauna return from your honeymoon, you need to come back and see me alone. Then it got worse. The counselor said, I want to introduce you to another counselor who specializes in family systems. Now, like most men, I mean, I can identify with this, you know, Steve felt like he'd already gone the extra mile by attending and paying for 4 premarital sessions with his counselor. And, you know, now this. And Steve's next question was the question I think most of us would have asked: how long is that going to take, right? His counselor smiled. He told me this story. His counselor smiled and said, well, probably several months. Of course, you know, Steve is stunned. He was shocked. Actually, he said he got mad. And here's the quote I love. He said, I got so mad, I pretty much confirmed my need for more counseling. And their counselor recognized that Steve and Shauna were not going to be grappling with typical first-year marriage problems. They were about to hit the buzzsaw of Steve's pre-existing condition, his past. Now, fortunately, Steve did what very few men, in my experience, are willing to do. 2 weeks after the honeymoon, he's back in the counselor's office alone. Why? Well, in light of Steve's past experience, it was the wise thing for him to do. Think about it. It wouldn't have been wrong not to go back. It wouldn't have been illegal or immoral not to go back. But Steve would tell you, it certainly would have been unwise. That was years ago. He's convinced that second round of counseling saved his marriage. His words, I would have blown it up and blamed her. So what about you? In light of your past experience, what is the wise thing for you to do? Financially, professionally, academically, where are you set up to fail because of something in your past, perhaps something you had no control over? In light of your personal past experience, what is the wise thing? Not the get by thing, not the what everybody else is doing thing. What is the wise thing for you to do? In light of my past experience and then my current circumstances. Now, you know this. Life is seasonal, right? So you owe it to yourself and the people around you to take your current emotions, your current state of mind into account whenever you're making a decision. Most of my apologies stem from my propensity to react in the moment, to the moment. When I wait, my responses are better. When I wait, my responses are more polite. When I wait, my responses are more accurate. When I'm mad, the wise thing for me to do is nothing. So when asking our fourth question, we would do well to take into account what's going on right now. In light of your current circumstances, in light of your current state of mind, what's the wise thing for you to do? Did you just get out of a relationship? Would it be wrong to jump back into another one? No, but in light of your recent circumstances and the emotions trailing along behind, is it the wise thing for you to do? Remember, Our greatest regrets, and I'm talking about usually our greatest relational regrets, our greatest regrets are almost always preceded by a series of unwise decisions. Jumping back into the dating game on the heels of a divorce or a breakup is usually a gateway decision. It leads to regret. In light of your current circumstances, what is the wise thing for you to do? And that brings us to our third and final perspective. In light of my past experiences, my current circumstances, and my future hopes and dreams, what is the wise thing for me to do? What is the wise thing for you to do? Now, from time to time, if you tune in, I'll ask you, what breaks your heart? What breaks your heart? I'll tell you what breaks my heart. It's related to the third facet of this question. What breaks my heart is watching people make decisions that undermine their own future, their own future hopes and dreams. It breaks my heart to watch individuals or couples make relationship decisions that are gonna undermine their relationship. It breaks my heart to watch teenagers make decisions that are gonna result in consequences that trail around behind them for maybe a decade or even two. It breaks my heart to watch parents parent in a way that will eventually drive a wedge between them and their children. It breaks my heart to watch people engineer their own unhappiness. Perhaps that's why I'm convinced this third application to our fourth question is the most important application. In light of your future hopes and dreams, in light of your future hopes and dreams, what is the wise thing for you to do? Chances are you have some idea of what you want your future to look like, right? I mean, you have a mental picture of a preferred future, what it could be and what it should be. You may have gone to the trouble of writing it down. You may not have a plan of how to get there, but you have some sense of where you want to be, right? And I'm guessing that when you envision your future, you don't envision yourself alone because nobody does. But here's the challenge. When it comes to dreams, when it comes to your dream, the deck is stacked against you because life is hard on dreams. There's always a headwind. And that being the case, if we're not careful, if you're not careful, you have the potential to contribute to the demise of what you hope for. And here's the thing. I don't want you to rob yourself of your own future. Nobody plans to undermine their own future. They just don't plan not to. But asking the wisdom question and acting on the wisdom question, that's how you plan not to. In light of your future hopes and dreams, what is the wise thing for you to do? Asking this question with the future in mind brings clarity to whatever option you're considering. It serves as like a purifying light. It all the deceptive shades of gray, they almost immediately dissipate. Our best option or our best options become clear, painfully clear. In fact, they become so clear, we're tempted to look away, to excuse ourselves away. But I'm not hurting anybody. I can handle it. There's no law against it. God will forgive me. And here's the thing. Our excuses are persuasive because they're mostly true. You aren't doing anything wrong yet. You can handle it initially. It isn't illegal. God will forgive you. But so what? That's all beside the point, right? The purpose of this fourth question isn't to stop you from doing something wrong. It's to keep you from doing something unwise. Again, unwise is a gateway. It's the gateway to regret. It paves the way to that tipping point. The point, in some cases, the point of no return. So, would you be willing to put away your old, worn out excuses once and for all? Come on, they have never served you well. They just silence your conscience, they cloud your reasoning, and ultimately, they really just diminish your ability to hear the voices of wisdom around you. Our excuses, you know what they do? They escort us to the threshold of regret. And once they get us there, do you know what your excuses do? They abandon you there with no margin for error. You've been there. I don't want you to ever go there again. So just decide to be done with all that. Instead of excusing yourself forward, dream and plan your way forward. Ask, in light of my future hopes and dreams, what is the wise thing for me to do? In light of where you want to be financially 5 or 10 years from now, what's the wise thing to do now? I mean, you're going to be somewhere 5 or 10 years from now financially, right? Shouldn't you decide? Do you know what? If you don't decide, you know who will decide? Retailers and lenders who care nothing about you. They will decide for you. And what's true financially is true relationally, academically, professionally as well. So come on, where do you want to be? Decide, write it down. If you're single, come on, if you're single, in light of what you ultimately want relationally, even romantically, what's the wisest way to conduct your relationships right now? What are you doing now? Think about it. What are you doing now that has the potential to rob you of your preferred future relationally? Now, that's a hard question to answer honestly, which takes us back to our first question in this series. Really, are you being honest with yourself? Are you being honest with yourself really? Are your relationships, come on, are your current relationships paving the way to your preferred relational future? Or are they escorting you to a place you don't want to be? A place you swore you would never go. In light of what you want later, what is the wise thing to do right now? If you're married and you're planning to go the distance with your spouse to finish together, to maybe enjoy grandchildren together, what can you do right now to facilitate that dream? What or who puts that dream at risk? What is the wise thing to do as it relates to protecting your marriage? You have children? Come on, what do you envision for your children in the future? What do you envision in terms of your relationship with your children in the future? What's the wise thing to do right now to protect that dream? Here's the thing, you know this. Everybody ends up somewhere in life, right? I want you to decide to live and to end up somewhere on purpose, and wisdom paves the way. Now, when teaching this question to university students or high school students, I always encourage them to commit the following little rhyme to memory. It goes like this. I wrote this many, many years ago. There's good and there's bad, but that's not my cue, but rather, what is the wise thing to do? There's good and there's bad, but that's not my cue. In other words, good and bad, that's no longer the filter through which I'm making decisions. My filter is better than that. There's good and there's bad, but that's not my cue, but rather, what is the wise thing to do? Don't settle for good. Don't settle for legal, permissible, acceptable, or even tolerable. If you do, you'll eventually find yourself living dangerously close to regret. You're better than that. You deserve better than that. Your family, the people who depend on you, they deserve better than that. Think about this. You are a unique blend. You are a unique blend of past experiences, current circumstances, and future hopes and dreams. And this question, the wisdom question, allows you to customize the decision-making process to your specific professional, financial, relational, or academic aspirations. So ask it. Ask it even if you don't plan to act on it. What is the wise thing for me to do? You owe it to yourself to know, right? In fact, I think you owe it to the people depending on you to know as well. So one last time, in light of your past experience, your current circumstances, and your future hopes and dreams, what is the wise thing for you to do? And we will pick it up right there next time when we explore our fifth question, our final question, the relationship question. I'll see you next time right here on Your Move. Hey everybody, welcome to Your Move. I'm Andy Stanley. There are four things that will eat you up from the inside out. Guilt, anger, greed, and jealousy. Guilt, anger, greed, and jealousy. And today, I'm gonna tell you how to eliminate all four. So stick around. Today we're talking about guardrails. This is our fourth in the series on guardrails. If you've been with us for a while, you know why we call the series guardrails, but if not, a guardrail, as you already know, is a system designed to keep vehicles from straying into dangerous or off-limit areas. Guardrails are never placed in the danger zone. Guardrails are always placed in the what? The safety zone. Guardrails are designed on the highway to do two things, primarily to direct us and protect us. But as we've said throughout this series, the highway is not the only place we need guardrails in our lives. We need some financial guardrails. We need some moral guardrails. We need relational guardrails. We need guardrails in our marriage. And specifically, when we talk about a guardrail outside the context of the highway or curves or bridges, a guardrail is actually a personal standard of behavior that becomes a matter of conscience. So today, as we wrap up this series, I want to talk about what I think is the most important guardrail of all for all of us to establish. I want to talk about how to guard your heart. Solomon, who was considered in the ancient times to be the wisest person that ever lived, some people still think he's the wisest person that ever lived. He wrote about money, relationships, marriage, all kinds of relationships, work, the hope in life. He wrote about everything. But in the book of Proverbs, he says essentially, hey, all that stuff I wrote about, it's really important, but there's one thing I don't want you to miss. If you forget everything else I said, if you ever had that conversation with one of your parents or maybe with one of your kids, if you forget everything else I said, here's what Solomon says. If you forget everything else I said, above all else, guard your heart. Guard your heart. I've said a lot of important things, but above everything I've said, guard your heart. Well, Solomon, why is that such a big deal? And he says this, everything you do flows from it. Now, what if that's true? And this isn't even like a religious thought. I mean, what if that's true? What if everything we do erupts from or flows from something that's on the inside of us? What if everything we do originates within? Well, if that's the case, then whatever within is, and obviously it's not our physical heart, but it comes from within us somewhere. If that's the case, then learning to guard that within part because it impacts the without part would be super important. So the question is, what does it look like? What does it look like to begin to guard your heart? So one day, 1,000 years after Solomon wrote that, 1,000 years later, Jesus is with his guys, and they're doing their Jesus and their disciples thing, healing people and teaching and preaching. And wherever Jesus went, perhaps you know this, wherever Jesus went, there was a cloud that followed him of religious leaders, Pharisees, teachers of the law, scribes, priests, high priests, all kinds of people. And they would be on the outside of the crowd because their goal was to trick Jesus and to drive a wedge between he and the crowd so that once they could isolate him, they could arrest him. Because as long as there was a crowd, the religious leaders weren't allowed. But every once in a while, they would work their way to the front of the line and say, Jesus, we have a question for you. And their questions were always trick questions, which makes reading the Gospels fascinating. So on one of these particular days, a couple of guys made their way to the front of the crowd and they said, Jesus, we have a question for you. Why do your disciples, the folks that follow you most closely, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? I'll explain what that is in just a minute. Why don't they wash their hands before they eat? What they were referring to is this. In the Old Testament law, the high priest and the priest and anybody that was to do sacred work before God had to do certain ceremonial washings to make sure they were always ready to do God's work, because you did not want to touch something unclean and then do God's work. So your hands had to constantly be clean. Well, over time, and so this was a tradition they had, it was a law they had for the religious leaders, but then they turned it into a tradition for everybody, and they imposed on everybody else this sort of guardrail rule that said everybody needs to do these ceremonial washings so they don't accidentally touch something unclean, like something dead or blood or something that was off limits to ancient Jewish people, touch that and then touch food and put the food in their mouth. So they said everybody needs to do these washings. Well, the law didn't teach that, so Jesus wasn't breaking one of the Ten Commandments or one of the laws. He just wasn't paying attention to one of their traditions because they made it up. And Jesus chuckled and thought to himself, are you crazy to bring this up? And he said to them, Jesus replied, okay, well, let me ask you a question. Why do you actually break the command of God for the sake of your tradition? You're accusing me of breaking a tradition that's not even a command of God. You actually break a command of God in order to protect one of your man-made traditions. And so Jesus tells them exactly what he's talking about. He said, for God said, and then he names one of the top 10. This is like in the table of contents for the entire law. And God said, honor your father and your mother, which they all knew that law. But you say that if anyone declares that what might have been used to help their father or mother is devoted to God, they are not to honor their father and their mother with it. Now, his audience knew exactly what he was talking about. We read that and think, we have no idea what you're talking about. So here's what he was talking about. That these religious leaders had come up with a tradition that allowed them to violate the law to honor your father and their mother. And here's what their tradition was. It's pretty crafty. They had this rule that you could just verbally dedicate or give away everything you own. So a moderately wealthy person, very wealthy person, could just say, I dedicate all my belongings to the temple. Everything I own, I now give to the temple. But according to this tradition, you could use what you own to support you and your immediate family as long as you lived. So what they did is they came up with a rule that kept them from being generous, because anytime somebody said, ask them to do something, they could say, no giving while I'm living. There's no giving while I'm living. There's no giving while I'm living, because I've already given everything to the temple. Now God allows me to use all this wealth to support me and my immediate family. And so what would happen is their aging parents would come to them asking for support. Get this. And they would say to their parents, oh, mom, oh, dad, I would love to help you out, but I can't give you anything because I've already dedicated it to God. So Jesus, he is having none of that. He says, thus you nullify the word of God for the sake of your stupid, I added that word, your stupid tradition, you hypocrites. You've come up with a rule to keep that allows you to get by with not obeying the overt will of God. Honor your father and your mother. Now, the religious leaders shrink back into the crowd, and they shrink back into the crowd kind of going, who came up with that stupid question? I don't know what might have. You said it was a good question, because they would just humiliate themselves constantly in front of the crowd. So then Jesus, you should read the Gospels. It's fascinating. Okay, so then Jesus turns, you know, to the crowd, because all the, you know, the religious leaders have walked off for the time being. He says to the crowd, listen to me. I want to make sure you understand what just happened between me and the religious leaders. I want to make sure you're clear. Jesus called to the crowd to him and said, listen and understand. And then they're all leaning in. He says, okay, just want to make this clear. What goes into someone's mouth does not defile them. In other words, what you put in your mouth does not put you at odds with God. Now, this was a brand new idea. The law, the ancient law of Moses, God's contract with Israel, was all about staying clean. It was all vertical. Is God happy? Is God happy? Is God happy? Let's keep God happy. It was all eye to the sky. And Jesus says, that day is coming to an end. What you put in your mouth is no longer going to defile you in the presence of God. But what comes out of your mouth is what defiles you. And Jesus turns to his guys, and I think he was having fun with them, honestly. He said this, he said, are you still so dull? Are you still so dumb? Are you not able to follow me? And they're like, follow me. So Jesus gathers his 12, now he's got the small group, and he says, okay. And he says, I'm gonna go slow, I wanna make sure you understand this, so I'm gonna go slow. You tell me if I'm going too fast for you guys, okay. Don't you see that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach? Everybody following me? Like, yeah. And then out of the body. Everybody following me? God's like, Jesus, we know that. Duh. He's like, I just want to make sure, you know, I was not going too fast for you, okay? Into the mouth, into the stomach, out of the body. And they kind of chuckle. And then Jesus gets serious. And he says, but the things that come out of a person's mouth come from the heart. The things that come out of a person's mouth come from inside the person, and he uses the heart as sort of this figure of speech. The things that come out of a person's mouth, they come from the heart. And now he gets real serious. And that's what defiles them. And it's these things, these that defile a person. The thing that puts a person at odds with God is not what goes in, it's what comes out. The thing that puts a person at odds with God is not what they eat, but how their words affect the people that God loves, that words that offend others offend God. I'm telling you, as obvious as that may be to some of us, this was brand new territory. This was a complete reversal of everything they had been brought up to believe, because they had been brought up to believe that priority number one is keep God happy. And you keep God happy by doing certain things, not doing certain things. I mean, if other people aren't happy, too bad. Got to keep God happy. And then Jesus says this. You ready? If you've been daydreaming or doing something else at home, okay, don't miss this part. This is super important. For, says Jesus, for out of the heart come evil thoughts. Murder, that's an activity. Adultery, that's an activity. Sexual immorality, that's an activity. Theft, false testimony, slander. He says, from the heart comes all these things that defile a person. Well, why do these defile people? Because they hurt people. And when you hurt people God loves, you hurt God. And when you offend people that God loves, you offend God. And when you do things that harms other people, it offends God. That's what defiles a person in God's presence. It's not what goes in. It's what comes out and how it affects other people. These, he said, these behaviors that impact other people, these horizontal behaviors, these are what defile a person. This is what makes God a little bit upset. So they're going, wait, so mistreating other people puts us at odds with God? Not breaking dietary laws and cleanliness laws? Jesus says, no, I want to make sure you know. But eating with unwashed hands does not defile them. If what harms people offends God, and the behavior that harms people that is sourced in our hearts, so if what offends God is what offends people, and what offends people comes from our hearts, then we need to guard our hearts. In other words, according to Jesus, our behavior will eventually mirror our hearts. And our hearts will eventually show up in our behavior. But our behavior eventually mirrors our hearts. And what's in our hearts eventually flows out into our behavior. Now, the interesting thing is, you already know this. You may have not have thought of it in these terms, but you've seen this. You've seen this in your life. You've seen this in the lives of other people, right? I mean, do you know anybody that blew up a career because of what came out of here? Do you know anybody that burned down a marriage with their tongue? Do you know anybody that alienated their children because of how they behaved in the home? And some of these very people, in fact, some of us are some of those very people, aren't we? And we look back and think, what was that? Who was I? Where in the world did that come from? So, as we kind of wrap up this series, I want to spend our last few minutes talking about four emotions that should ding your conscience. That when you think these thoughts or feel these feelings, when you think these thoughts or feel these feelings, when your mind starts to go down this trail, it should bother you. It should light up your conscience. It should remind you, or it should inform you, that you have some work to do. Because if you do not deal with what's on the inside, it eventually makes its way to the outside. And not only do you hurt you, and not only do you hurt perhaps the people you love the most, it's offensive to God. And it's not offensive to God because he's so sensitive and, you know, so emotional. It's offensive to God because God loves the people you hurt. And God loves you. And when you love someone, you don't want to see them hurt themselves. And when you love someone, you don't want them to be hurt by someone else. So these should tip you off. These are, you can think of it this way. These are like internal tensions that deserve, in fact, I think they demand our attention. So here they are, four emotions, guardrails for the heart: guilt, anger, greed, and jealousy. Guilt, anger, greed, and jealousy. Guilt, anger, greed, and jealousy. When you identify these, because greed you don't even feel, but you may identify it. When you feel it or identify it, you have work to do. There is something in you that has the potential to create chaos outside of you. And our tendency, right? Our tendency is to wait until we've said something, to wait until we've done something. That's like putting the guardrail in the danger zone. We want to put the guardrail in the safety zone, which means we start paying attention as soon as there is an internal tension. Guilt says, I owe you. I owe you an apology. I owe you something because I took something from you and you don't know about it. Or maybe you do, but I'm too proud to admit it. Guilt says, I owe you. It leads to walls, inauthenticity, right? Dishonesty. Guilt leads to secret keeping. It leads to creating distance. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. How long are we going to do this the rest of our marriage? What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. Well, there's something wrong. I don't want to tell you because I'm carrying something, and it seeps into our words, and it makes its way into our relationships. Anger says, you owe me because you hurt me. You took something from me. You either pay me back or I pay you back. Now, the problem with anger, and we all know this, is that anger leaks. Anger is not stationary. Anger is mobile. Anger leaks into our other relationships. Another way of saying it is that anger is never isolated to the relation of origin. In other words, you were hurt as a kid. You were hurt in that last job. You were hurt by that last girl. You were hurt when he broke up and the way he broke up and the way you found out. And you're carrying that anger. But anger says that you owe me. And until you pay me back, I'm going to hold this over you. And I'm going to hold it over anyone who reminds me of you. And long after you're out of my life, I'm still going to hold other people hostage to what you took from me. Greed says, I owe me. It's what we talked about last week. So what is greed? Greed is the assumption that it's all for my consumption. That's right. Greed is the assumption it's all for my consumption. So greed is, I owe me, and I know you're in need, and I know there's these people that are struggling, and I know that the folks at work are raising money for, and as much as my heart goes out to them, my money does not. And as much as I feel sorry for what they're going through, I don't feel so sorry that I'm going to write a check. Because I owe me. And oh yeah, it's heartbreaking, but when it comes to actually writing that check,
I can't do that. It becomes a filter for all of our decisions. You know what else happens with greed? Men, if we're not careful because we like stuff, men, the people in our families, the people closest to us, will feel like they're competing with our stuff. They'll feel like the car is actually more important than her or him. That making sure that stays, you know, buttoned up and tightened up and, you know, locked up and insured, you know, don't go in there, or I'm going to let you look, but kids don't touch. After a while, listen, when your children feel like they're competing with your stuff, you have a greed problem. You do. Jealousy, life owes me. Somebody got what I deserve. She got who I deserve. He got what I deserve. Life owes me. And now you don't like them. And now it's almost impossible to be nice to them. You know what else happens with jealousy? This is the ickiest, ickiest, ickiest thing. And when this rises up in me, I mean, I just speak it out loud because I think it is the worst, grossest, I don't know another word I can use in public. This is the ist stuff I can think of. It's when I find myself secretly celebrating someone else's loss or failure. Is there anything worse than that? Is there anything lower than that? If that is in you and if that is in me, that should set off alarm bells in our conscience because it will eventually leak. So when you feel it, when you see it, you got to address it. When you feel it, when you see it, when you notice it, when somebody else notices it in you, and of course you say, oh, no, 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 but then you walk away going, oh, yes, 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 I think yes. In fact, I can't even admit it. I'm so embarrassed by it. You got to address it. Now, I'm going to give you some suggestions over here in this third column, but before I do, let me just say this real quick. If you're not a Christian, I have, and you already know this, but I just want to make sure you know that I know, I have no right in the world to tell you what to do. And just because Jesus said something doesn't mean you're obligated to do it. You've never signed on as a Jesus follower, so I get that. But let me just say one more thing. If you're not a Christian or you're coming back or you're considering it, what we're about to talk about in the next 5.5 minutes is why following Jesus will make your life better and it will make you better at life. Even if you haven't come to the point and never come to the point that you can acknowledge that Jesus is who Jesus claimed he was, following Jesus, the way we're about to talk about, this is why we say following Jesus makes your life better and will make you better at life. It'll make you a better husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend or just friend or employee or employer. It'll just make you a better person. That's why Jesus' invitation was follow me, follow me, follow me. And I'm going to ask you to do things that don't necessarily make any sense emotionally, but at the end of the day, at the end of the decision, you will experience a freedom and a peace that perhaps you've never, ever experienced before. So these are 4 preventative, in a way, heart exercises to keep you out of a ditch, to keep you from going outside the rails. And as I said, they are precisely the opposite of what we feel like doing or want to do. So what do we do with our guilt? These are just 4 words, as we confess. And not to God. Look up here. He already knows. When you confess to God, God doesn't go, what? Hey, somebody, come here. You're not keeping me up to date on what's going on. Well, I had no idea. I'm so sorry. But this is what you were raised to do. You were raised, oh, come on, you were either raised to tell someone you barely know and never see in your real life, or you were told to tell God. The confession that heals and the confession that deals with guilt has to do with confession to somebody who is in your life, and ultimately to confess to the person that you hurt and that you stole something from. And it will damage your reputation. That's what guardrails do, minimal damage. It may damage your marriage or your relationship with your fiance or your boyfriend. But if it's temporary, then it's minimal damage. That's the nature of a guardrail. It's minimal damage. But the longer you carry that guilt, the longer it eats you up inside and is going to drive you to other behaviors that eventually you're going to either have to confess or somebody's going to find out. Come on. Secrets suck the life out of you. And secrets suck the passion and the life out of a relationship. So if you were God and you loved you the way God loves you, what do you think you would say? You would say, come on, let's get rid of that. I want you to confess. And yeah, you're going to have to swallow your pride, but come on, your pride is why you did what you did to begin with. Confess it. And if you don't think you're ready to confess to the person you actually hurt, because that's too big of a step, then I would beg you, confess it to someone who is in your life, a trusted friend, somebody in your group, somebody at work, somebody that they're not a counselor, they're not going to try to fix it for you, but you need to get it out And when you get it out and can look at it, chances are you'll take that next step. And eventually you will confess to the person that you hurt. And when you do, look up here, this is important. There will be a measure of chaos out here, but there will be a level and a measure of peace in here. And this will eventually dissipate, and this will eventually be something you work through. But you will have set yourself up for future success by simply doing the difficult work of confessing. Anger, we already know the answer to this. It's forgive. Do you know what forgiveness is? Forgiveness is identifying specifically what was taken from me and deciding you don't owe me anymore. It's not enough to say I had a terrible dad or I had a terrible mom or my boss. Okay, they were terrible, granted. But what did they take from you? What specifically was taken from you? You've got to identify specifically what was taken from you, and then you have to look at it and say, I'm making a decision. You don't owe me this anymore. I'm canceling the debt. That's what forgiveness is. It's canceling a debt, to which we say, I feel like I'm letting them off. You are. That's why I feel so bad. But you're letting somebody else off as well. You. Because you're digging up all of this out of your heart and you're saying, I will not be ruled by this anymore. It's not gonna follow me into my next relationship. It's not gonna follow me into my next marriage. It's not gonna impact the way I discipline my kids. I'm done. I am deciding you don't owe me. You are forgiven. And what do about greed? We give. We give. We write some big to you checks. You know what a big to you check is? It's a check that's big to you. It may not be big to me, may not be big to the person behind you, but to you, it's a big check. It may be a huge check compared to me, but to you, it's just a big check. You write some big to you checks. You decide, you know what, greed? You're not controlling me anymore. Watch this. I'm writing a check and I'm giving it to this nonprofit. Nah, nah, nah. And they didn't even ask. Ha, ha, ha. You don't control me anymore. If you want to get serious, find something precious. An object, not a child, okay? Find some, not someone, a something. You find something precious, like don't touch that, don't go in there, don't get your hands on that. You know, we keep it behind glass, and you sell it, and you give the money away. And you go, aha, these objects will not control me anymore. I'm not about stuff that somebody else is gonna have to sell. And I'm not against having stuff and I'm not against collecting stuff. But when it becomes the priority over people, you have a greed problem. And you can't continue to be consumed by what isn't even yours to consume. Christians don't trust in riches. We trust in Him who richly provides. Now, jealousy, we said that, you know, life owes me. But if you want to deal with jealousy, you've got to be willing to admit what the real problem is. And it's not that life owes you. At the end of the day, if you're honest, you believe God owes you. This is an issue not between you and your sister-in-law because she married well or because she has something or because she, you know, whatever it was you wanted, now she has it, or your brother-in-law or your roommate because she's kind of moving on with her life and you feel like you're in a cul-de-sac. It really has nothing to do with them. It has to do with what you think God owes you that God didn't give you. Because the truth is, see, life happens, but God takes what happens and makes things happen when we receive what comes our way from His hands and ask Him to do with it whatever He pleases. The way you respond to jealousy is you begin to celebrate. You begin to celebrate what God has given you, and you begin to celebrate what God has given others. You begin to celebrate what God has given you, and you begin to celebrate out loud. Dear Frank, congratulations on the promotion. As you know, I was really hoping to get it, but I am genuinely happy for you. Love, and then you put it in an envelope and you say, jealousy, you do not live in my heart any longer. I am genuinely happy for you. You say, well, I don't feel it. It doesn't matter if you feel it. You are going to behave your way past these things that have the potential, come on, to pollute our heart and pollute our soul. Who has what you think you deserve? You need to figure out a way to celebrate them out loud. Now, for some of you, you need to do a little bit of some mirror work. You know what I mean? Mirror work is when you look in the mirror and you start talking to these things. Guilt, you're not living in my heart anymore. I'm confessing. Anger, you're not gonna live in my heart anymore. I'm forgiving. Watch this, I'm gonna forgive. In fact, I'm even gonna write a list of all the things that were taken from me. I'm gonna put an envelope and decide they don't owe me anymore because anger, you're not gonna live in my heart anymore. I'm not carting you around from relationship to relationship to relationship to relationship. And greed, I'm going to write some big checks, okay? Greed, I'm going to be almost unhealthily generous until I can become a cheerful giver. Because see, some of you think you got to be cheerful before you give. That's not true. You give till you become cheerful. If you have to wait till you're cheerful, come on, you're never going to give, because the cheerfulness of giving is the response to what happens when God opens your hands in your heart. You realize, you know what? I'm actually happier and I have more peace without it than I did clinging to it, protecting it, cleaning it, and ensuring it. Clinging to anything that you know you have hurt some people's feelings over stuff. Have you recently, even in your heart, celebrated somebody else's failure? Celebrated the fact that life didn't work out for them the way you know they hoped it would work out for them? If so, that's dangerous. Because if it's in there, it's going to come out of there. And it will defile you with God. Not because God is squeamish, because God loves you and loves the people that your words and actions have the potential to hurt. So, above all else, guard your heart. For everything you do flows from it.